The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this video is not covered under our Creative Commons license. See the closing credits for more information.
Cool. Thanks, guys, for coming. All this stuff will be. I'll make sure that the slides and everything are available after this. And so, what I'm going to be talking to you guys about today is some game design fundamentals. And as I'll mention a little bit later on, a lot of this stuff is what I've learned over the past like 6 or 7 years working on games. What are some of the tools that I use to build games? How do I think about structuring them and making them and kind of going through? And so, we're going to be talking a lot about Pac-Man, so I hope most of you guys have played it or at least seen it, because we're actually going to be looking at it a bunch today. But these are the sort of topics we're going to cover. I'm going to go quickly through the game design definition stuff, mainly just because I think it's helpful to set the stage, and then we're going to talk about the kind of core things in there, which is mostly the moment-based design is the most important, and then we'll talk through some other things. The experience architecture, flow, and indirect control are all things that, all like direct tools that I've used, and hopefully there'll be some takeaways here where you guys can just, you know, start applying some of these thoughts and ideas to the games you're actually making. So just really quickly, who am I? Rick covered some of this, but basically I went to graduate school at Carnegie Mellon. My undergrad was in mechanical engineering, and I decided I didn't want to do mechanical engineering anymore, so I decided to go to graduate school. I then worked briefly at Imagineering during my intern. I did an internship there. I went to Carnegie Mellon thinking that that was what I wanted to do, and then I started making games, and I didn't look back. But Imagineering was an awesome experience. I left there and joined Conduit Labs, and we released this was back before there was a Facebook platform, and we were making social music games on the web. And so we made a game called Loud Crowd, which was kind of a chat room and with DDR at the same time, so you could actually like dance with other people. And then after the Facebook platform came out, we made a game called Music Pets. And this game hit at the right time and was able to get to 1 million monthly active users when that really mattered. And that sort of caught the eye of Zynga. So Zynga purchased Conduit. We were 11 people at the time. We grew that team to 60 to release Adventure World. Which then became Indiana Jones Adventure World. That's a longer story as to how that happened. And then almost a year ago exactly, Zynga laid us all off, closed the studio, and fired about 50 people. So I got together with four of the other sort of senior members of that team and decided to start Proletariat. And so we started Proletariat. It'll be a year next Saturday from when we officially started. And we just announced our first major title, which is World Domination. We actually just released a gameplay video this morning. So you guys check out Joystick. I think it was on there. So that's who I am. I started out in the game industry as a gameplay engineer, doing both design and engineering. And that's some of the stuff that I still enjoy doing now, despite my title change. Just really quickly, I like to give a disclaimer whenever I teach game design. The problem with teaching game design is there's like a lot of lore involved. There's a lot of, you know, everyone has their own opinions on how to create a good game and how to make a hit. And it's, I liken it to trying to kill a vampire. There's a bunch of stories of people that maybe have done it before, but you never really quite know. And they'll recommend different things. People will say, like, I killed this vampire with garlic and this one with a silver bullet and this one with a wooden stake. And the reality is that you actually, when you face your own vampire, when you're trying to make your own game, you want every tool in the chest. Think about this. Think about the stuff that I'm going to talk about today as just additional tools. This is not the way to make games. I don't think there is one. These are the things that have worked for me in the past and that I've found valuable. So just a bit of a disclaimer, this is not the only way to do it. So some definitions, just really quick. Play, I'm sure you guys all know about this. Games, play with a goal. And, you know, Sid Meier always describes it as a series of interesting choices. Does anyone know why I put Candyland up there?
Because there are no interesting choices in Candyland.
There's no choices in Candyland. You just pull a card and you move your piece. That's it. There's no choice. And then a toy is an interactive object used during play. And the very last one, which is comes up sometimes as a point of contention, is what is a puzzle? and it being a game with a dominant strategy, one where once you know it, the game is no longer fun. So, what is game design? We've talked a little bit about some of those definitions there, and if you, all sorts of people have different definitions on this. I like to try and get things as concrete as possible. So, game design is the craft of designing experiences that will evoke a specific emotional response. Well, okay, that's pretty good. So some of the skills that are kind of necessary for that is being a good listener, being a good teacher, which anyone that's played any games with sort of extended tutorials, something like Portal, they're just really great at teaching you new mechanics. And that's a lot of that becomes into, you know, not only being a good listener and a good teacher, but actually learning to play test well. This is something that I personally am not great at, and I painfully try to force myself to do it all the time to get into the mindset of the player. But like your fellow student mentioned earlier, it's really important to actually be able to play your own game and watch other people play it. When you see that, when you see them, you know, like you mentioned, coming to Boston Fig and just watching people play it, if you can get into the mindset of a player, it'll be much better. It's not very easy to do. You want to make sure that you're driven. The game industry is a tough place. I was actually just writing up a blog post earlier today about scary facts around the game industry. There's been close to 4,500 layoffs this year in the game industry, and that's actually down from last year. So it's a kind of a scary place. And the last thing is just never stop trying new experiences. This is something that is really important to game development in general. So that's great. I gave you a bunch of kind of high-level stuff, but seriously, what is the game design aspect of this? And I like to think about it as designing systems, mechanics, and stories that allow for interesting, fun, moving, emotional, and challenging moments. And the reason why I bolded moments there is because that's kind of the basis of the way I like to think about everything. I think about moments as the sort of building blocks for a good game experience. And that's we're going to spend a good bit of time talking about that and sort of looking at some good moments that are available in games. So that's great. Now, how the hell do we do that? You want to design and build stories, mechanics, and systems that create opportunities. This is all about, you want those moments to occur, but you can't just let them, you can't just force them on the player, right? That would be, you know, a book or a movie where they actually experience these moments, but it's passive for them. You're trying to create an opportunity for them to have that moment on their own volition, which is one of the big differences here. So let's talk about Pac-Man. How many people have played Pac-Man? Good, almost everybody. So Pac-Man was released May 20th, 1980. It grossed $1 billion. That is a lot of quarters. Spawned an animated TV series. How many people have seen this? Anybody? Find it on YouTube. It's worth it. There have been over 30-plus sequels and remakes. It's on every platform imaginable. You can play it on your watch. You can play it on your, you know, TV. You can play it everywhere. Yeah, it's been republished on every major console since its release. There's been some version of Pac-Man. And everyone basically, you know, considers it it's a really well-done game. And so I'm going to do this a couple of times in here, but I have a bunch of videos that I want to just show. This video we're going to look at a few times. Just to kind of... Sorry. Hold on one second. Get us all kind of caught up. All that music. So this is just a single level we'll watch really quickly, but just to remind you guys as to what the gameplay of Pac-Man is all about. So remember that when we're talking about moments, remember the fact that a lot of you guys just actually, like, you're not even playing. It's one of the things whenever I play, like, do play tests with actual users is I'd much rather watch them than watch what they're doing. because you want to see their reaction. You want to see the smiles on their faces, the confusion, all that stuff. Don't worry, we're going to watch that clip a few more times today. So just to kind of get a baseline here, what are some of the mechanics that we have in Pac-Man? What are some of the things, some of the actual like mechanical pieces that are kind of here? To start out, one of the things is pellets, right? This is what drives you to finish the level. This Pac-Man is one of those extremely well-designed games that does a really good job on a number of different levels. But one of the great things about the pellets is it forces you into a smaller and smaller area, heightening your overall intensity of the game, because you have to go into a smaller and smaller area where you don't want to do that, because that's where the ghosts are likely going to go. It also shows your overall progress of the level really well, kind of like right in your face the whole time. So the pellets are a really interesting mechanic just because they hit on so many different really well-done necessary parts of the game. Another part's the power pellets, right? This is where the roles flip and you can eat the ghosts. The ghosts themselves. And so we'll talk a bit more about the specific ghosts and their personalities and AIs. The bonus fruit. How many people saw when the bonus fruit came in? Right? So we'll talk a bit more about the bonus fruit and why I think it comes in later and why it's positioned where it is. Lives. So you have the actual lives you can see them down here in the corner here. And then the last one is, that's it. Then we have the systems. And the systems that we have in here is movement. So movement's really interesting in Pac-Man. Pac-Man always goes forward, right? You really can't stop him except by like driving him into a wall. And you just move the joystick to change direction. So he's just always moving forward on the original cabinets. Scoring, so 10,000 points gives you a high score. If you really wanted to know when I was making this talk originally, I actually watched one of those, like, someone trying to get the, like, perfect game of Pac-Man, because you can go, like, every single level all the way up. They're on YouTube. It takes, like, 6 hours or something like that. And people are kind of insane. Enemies, so each one with a specific AI. That's one of the systems in here. So like we mentioned before, we have mechanics and systems, and these are supposed to work together to create the opportunities for cool moments. The spawning. So this is important, sort of like where these things spawn and where the bonus fruit, where both the bonus fruit and the enemies spawn, will drive a lot of the kind of interesting gameplay. When we talk about this experience in general, this actual 2 minute clip specifically, we'll go through some of the reasons why that stuff's set up this way. And then the last thing, which I don't know if that came into play in this video specifically, but there's the tunnels, right? The tunnels on one side or the other. And that's kind of just like a hidden interesting thing, because you can see there's no pellets leading either way. It's just something that players can use. So that's great. So mechanics and systems, that's two of the three. The last one that we have to sort of set up these interesting moments is the story. So what's the story of Pac-Man? Anybody? Really, the only kind of story you get is in the sort of breakdown in character personalities of the actual ghosts themselves. And it's kind of interesting. There's this, you have the sort of actual character nickname and their actual character name, which is kind of funny. But you can tell that there's a lot that the designers are communicating through that. If you see, like, Binky, Pinky, and Inky all do somewhat close, similar AIs, where Clyde's, like, very different, right? His AI is very weird compared to the other ones. And so you can see, like, he kind of stands out in a lot of these different ways. And so the Shadow, Speedy, Bashful, those three all kind of explain very specifically how that AI works. And then again, like, Pokey is Clyde's, which is a very weird version of the AI. So there you go. There is some story to Pac-Man. I don't know what it is. Yep.
Isn't there also story in, like, the actual name of Pac-Man being, like, they wanted, like, because the original Japanese game was, like, called Pac-Man, and they were, like, didn't want to, like, actually keep it that way, because, like, that people, when they were trying to graffiti the streets, would actually write, like, racism, right?
Yes. Yeah. So that's, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's certainly the urban legend, is that they didn't want to use Pac-Man because you could just, like, rub off the part of the P to like make something very abusive. I don't know if that's true. That could be. I don't know. So we'll take a step back from the specific now and talk a little bit about moment-based design. Moment-based design is that's what I like to call it. That's sort of the way that I think about games. And it's based off of play-centric design. For anyone that's... How many people have seen this book by Tracy Fullerton? So Tracy Fullerton's a professor at USC. She's sort of... her gang have kind of produced a number of different games that are very similar to... You'll start to understand some of this when we talk through the specifics of this as to why games like Flower and Flow and Journey all kind of came out of this idea, this sort of way, this way of building games. But it starts with one major thing, which is, like, what do you want the player to feel? It's very a very emotional thing. And they have you list out experience goals. Like, what are the experiences that you want the player to have during this? Then they have you actually prototype the mechanics, play test them, and iterate. And those bottom three are just, that's just the way you should design games. It's that top one that's kind of the question of where do you start? What's the initial goal? The other three you should always do no matter what. So then your experience goals. So when she talks about these in the book, there's things like what will the player feel? And, you know, an example is, and players need to cooperate to win, but the game should be structurally never trust each other. Right? So you have this sort of counteroperative, cooperative situation going on where you could get backstabbed at any time, but you know you need to work together in order to win. Players will feel a sense of happiness and playfulness rather than competitiveness. Right? So you can see how you would structure a game to get that feeling. This is very much the sort of idea is to start with these feelings. The last one, the freedom to pursue goals of the game in any order that they choose. So these would sort of drive how you would structure the game, what sort of mechanics, what sort of systems, and what sort of story you would use to actually build this. So the difference for moment-based design is I like to actually get one layer deeper. So rather than just starting with the experience, going for a specific list of moments, actual moments that you want the player to have, and we'll talk through what some of those are, and then and building the structure backwards from that. And so then you want to prototype them, play test them, and iterate. I seem to spend a lot of my time during this, especially the iteration phase, looking at the different moments and being like, I want this one to happen more often. Or this one, you know, simply isn't interesting enough yet, so maybe there's iteration to be had on the moment itself. And we'll talk through what some of these, like, good moments are. This was the fun little fortune cookie that I found that was relevant. So when you want to brainstorm moments, right, like this is the sort of thing, there's a lot of questions you can ask. So things like, you know, when you're wondering what will the player experience, there's like how will the player interact with the experience? And that's going to drive a lot of things in the game when you answer this question. That's going to drive things like the platform, the controls, the camera, and specific mechanics, right? When you answer the question, what role does the player have in the experience? That's going to change. That's going to drive, you know, the story, how you want to set it up, right? Like, people play Pac-Man because it's fun, but there's nothing really aspirational about the half yellow circle, right? The interactions, the mechanics, and of course the camera again, right? Because if the player, if you want to see the character or not, is really important. You know, when and where does the experience take place? This is important. So answering these will drive a lot of this stuff. And then the last one: why would the player want to be part of the experience? And this is a lot with what's the inherent aspiration to play the game. So now we're actually going to get concrete. I have a bunch of examples here. I could probably do the whole thing with Ocarina of Time, but most of them are Ocarina of Time. Some of them are other games. Where we're actually going to talk through some. These are not all the moments, but some moments that I think are valuable, and specifically, you know, looking at them as moments and how they were structured by the designers. So outsmarting the AI. Providing powerful feedback, being surprised, especially if you're lucky, learning and mastering a skill, and then winning. You'll notice that almost all of these, I think all of these are positive moments. You actually need to have negative ones too. I don't want to neglect those because it's really important. You need to have things like, you know, it's a moment when you lose a life in Pac-Man. It's an important moment in sort of that experience. And it's important to have that just to be a counter to some of the other things that occur. So, you know, when you're thinking through moments, it's not just good ones. You want to think through also, like, the negative moments, but they're part of the game. You know, how many people have died on a boss and you know, kind of laughed at themselves or thought that it's, you know, and that kind of internal thought is an interesting moment that adds to the experience. So we'll start with outsmarting the AI game. So this is all about predicting what the enemy will do. How many people have heard of the idea of a tell? Right? So this comes up a lot, specifically in poker. But the idea here is that a tell is something where if you can find a competitor's tell, you can likely be able to predict their next move. This is incredibly important in games. This is used everywhere. This sort of feedback is something that you, if you start to look for it, you'll realize is there. And what it's doing is it's like the game designers setting the player up to just like, hey, this is coming, this is coming, this is coming, get ready. And then they do it. And the player feels great about it because he's like, oh, I learned that. I learned what that tell is going to be and I know how to do it. The other part of kind of outsmarting this is using a clever strategy to defeat the enemy, something that, it's not outsmarting the game if it's just a dice roll. You know, like winning in Candyland is not that great because it's just like, oh, that's how the cards were set up and where I sat down at the table. Especially if this is unexpected or unconventional, and that's the example that I'm going to use here. And then the last one is winning the game without even knowing. The reason why this is an interesting moment, I don't know if anyone's experienced this. I was trying to think of a really good example, but it's not great to just win and then not even know. When you want to feel like you were smart, whenever you can make the player feel smart, that's a win for you as the game designer. That's your goal, is to make them feel smart. So, take a look at Ocarina of Time. So, how many people have played Ocarina of Time? Awesome. So this is early on in the game. Just mute this. We don't really need the sound. This particular part. So most of the Zelda games are about combat, right? They're sort of like puzzly combat. There's additional tools you get, and there's like dungeons and boss fights. This particular part of Ocarina of Time, you can't fight the guards. You're a little kid. If you get seen by the guards, you get sent back to the beginning of this, like, courtyard. What you need to do is get through it. And so this is kind of a very simplified version of a stealth game. But if you watch, the guards have very specific tells, so you know what direction they're going to go, like, what their sort of path is, right? Even just looking here on the screenshot, you can probably guess, like, his path is going to be around that square. And then if you watch once, he actually does very specific things before he moves again, like how long he waits at each spot. So stops, looks both ways, moves. And what this is a tell, right? Now you know as a player how that's going to go. This next one, similar. He moves a little bit faster. There's two of them now. One moves fast, one moves slow. So you need to do the timing correctly. This one's kind of interesting. So we'll talk about this when we get into some of the Pac-Man stuff specifically, but you'll notice that in the other two, there were no rupees there. And it's because like the game's trying to teach you in like a relatively safe space how this mechanic works, saying like, hey, this is how this works, you know, Just get through it. The reward for getting through this is to get through it. Now, you've done it twice, and they're like, okay, you're good. Now, if you want to actually prove that you're awesome, go ahead and do some risk versus reward here, right? So now the path where he actually walks has rupees in it. And so you can try to get down there and actually get that if you think you can figure out what the way he's going to walk and the timing of it. This person, I think, just gets a couple of them. And you could just go straight across, right? You could go straight across the top and not even worry about it. But it's so tempting. And And so what they're doing is just setting up. You know, it's very easy to tell, even at first glance, which way they're going to move and how they're going to go. And this is a lot to do with not only level design, but also like the way the characters' animations go, and just the way all the general feedback that the player is getting at this point as to how these characters move. And that tell is what makes them feel, is what makes the player feel smart, right? Like, I know where they're going to go. I'm able to predict that and then make a strategic action to counter it. So powerful feedback. People like to play games because they like really great feedback. It's always, I love watching people play some of the, they haven't released one in a while, but some of the best of last generation's Prince of Persia games, because it's like so awesome. Like Mirror's Edge, I think, is a great one too, where you just have like all this crazy like running and doing all this stuff, and all you're doing is hitting like three buttons at the right time. But man, on screen, does that look great, right? It looks so cool. And that just feels really good. And the video we're going to look at is Batman. I really like the new set of Batman games, the Arkham games. And we'll look at the way the feedback kind of goes there. And you want to make the player feel heroic, feel outstanding. Like you want a small action in the real world to have a massive impact in the game, because that's something that players inherently like. Yeah, small effort, big impact. So how many people have played any of the Batman games? So, if I could plug them very quickly, you should play Arkham City at least far enough to go and fight Mr. Freeze. It's probably the best boss fight of last generation's consoles, I think. And that's not hyperbole, I really think it's that good. I'm going to mute this because there's a guy talking over it, but for Batman, you really, you know, he's supposed to be, in the new iteration, this like awesome like ninjutsu guy, and they do this great thing where you can just fight all these dudes, but you're hitting one button. One, that's it. You're just tapping one button, and then when you see those lightning bolts. So, what are those lightning bolts there? Hold on, let me see if I can pause it at one.
They're tells.
Right, exactly. They're tells, and what are you supposed to do when you see that? Yeah, you hit a different button. So this is all with two buttons, but man, like, look at how awesome that is. Like, I guess you have to use the joystick slightly to kind of pick your direction, but, you know, and you got the bats flying out from every single enemy that you actually defeat. And my favorite is the very last part, right? When you have one enemy left, they do this awesome, like, really cinematic thing, right? Where they zoom it in and they show him just, like, hammering the guy. And all of that was, like, two buttons, right? That was really over the top. But that's one of the main selling points of this entire game, is like that whole structure. The fact that they make something that seems so impossibly complicated easy and approachable to play. And again, like once you start looking for tells in games, you're going to see them everywhere. So that's a great example of a tell, that lightning bolt thing. Being surprised or lucky, I love this video coming up. When you get an unexpectedly good outcome, and this is even better if it's rare, how many people have played an MMO or an RPG and they've gotten like a super rare drop? And it's like made their day, right? Yeah, this one kind of needs no explanation. The video is really great, though. I'm going to make sure that the sound is on. Because it's, you know, so this is, in World of Warcraft, there's a chance for a rare mount drop off of this boss. And it's like supposed to be really, really rare.
Oh my god! Oh my god! Are you kidding with me? Dude! Do my own job!
I'm needing all that.
I'm needing for that shit also. Congrats if you get it. I won it. Oh my god!
Like, look,
are you kidding?
Just listen to the joy in her voice, right?
0.01.
And so it's that sort of.
Oh my god!
See? It's like made her day, right? Maybe even made her week. But that's a memorable moment, right? That's something you're going to remember for a long time. The fact that a lot of you actually remembered, you know, you can't remember all the different pieces of loot you got, even the ones that were marginally good rolls, but that really rare one, you're going to always remember that, right? There are people that will remember that for a long time because It's like winning the lottery, right? You feel very special. So mastering a skill, learning a skill. This is all about being a good teacher. This is all about doing the sort of the way that Ocarina of Time sets up. Hey, this is the skill you have to learn. Now we're going to make you master it and kind of like tweak it a little bit. I like to think about this stuff mainly as trying to teach a vocabulary word, right? You want to have them learn it in a safe space, like actually learn what the vocabulary word is, like hear it for the first time. You want them to understand the definition. Then you want them to use it in a sentence, and then you just expect them to use it in every, you know, in their own writing whenever they want. And that's the sort of structure in terms of learning and mastering a skill. And so you want to make sure that once you teach this, you make people reuse it. One-off mechanics always feel awkward when you learn it only once and you're never expected to do it again in the game. But really good games will call this back up all the time, and it can be super trivial things, but you still feel good as a player because it's more that you've learned about the world. It's like additional depth that you know, and you're making the player feel smart every time. Because players always love having the right answer. So we're going to go back to Ocarina of Time again. So Ocarina of Time does this thing where it tells you straight up, memorize this song. Although you can look it up at any time, so... I mean, there's a couple of things that are really well done here. It's also almost in the shape of the Triforce with the notes and the... So you're told to learn this song. And then, first of all, I love his reaction, right? Like, oh my god, this is so awesome! When we talk about indirect control, we'll talk a little bit about sort of the reactions of your avatar and how it impacts you. But, so it teaches you, and then all throughout the rest of the game, you're sort of expected to use it again. So, in this fountain, whenever you see this, whenever you see this golden Triforce on the ground here, you use that song, you play that song. The player knows to use it. Because you've taught it once, and then you just keep bringing it back up every time. And they do this with several of the songs, that there's like, hey, here's the right moment to actually use that thing. And because it was like taught to the player, there's just this feeling of like, yep, I know the secret, and so I'm going to be able to use what this is. Even though it wasn't a secret, you had to learn it. It's just the way the context it's sort of set in. And so, you know, and then there's always something interesting and cool that happens. This calls down the one of the great fairies, which for whatever reason are like the one thing that really doesn't stand up for me in the course of like trying this game out, you know, 10 or whatever years later. It's like, wow, those are really weird. I don't know, maybe because I was like much younger then, they didn't really bother me, but I see those now and I'm like, I realize I didn't have any polygons to work with, but... Yeah, it's just so sharp and like everything is... So winning, this very last one. So giving great feedback when players make the right choice. And this is... A lot of this is mostly based around just like any possible avenue, any channel you can use to give good feedback. And I wanted to take a look at a big example of this first. And what we'll do is we'll look at defeating the last boss in Ocarina of Time. And it's like really clear that what you've done, you get really awesome feedback that you've defeated the boss. Like he's laying on the ground before we actually watch it. He's laying on the ground and then he just starts flailing and does like the greatest like most extravagant death animation ever, even though he was like already on the ground, but he gets like back up to die. And then we'll look at a smaller example as well, which I think is important just in terms of like winning doesn't have to necessarily be a big like boss fight. It's like any time the player does something right, like give them feedback on that. So this is the on the top of the tower. I'm ruining this for anybody that hasn't beaten this game, but shame on you. So she like holds him down, like great. He's like just lying there. Now watch this death animation. Look at the like feedback for the player. He's dead. Oh wait. And now you get even more help, right? The sixth sage is going to like lock him away. And there's just so much effort put into like making sure that the player knows that they've won. You really want them to know, like, hey, this you just did something awesome, and we're just going to pour it on for like the next 60 seconds. We're just going to like keep going about how great and how awesome you are, even though it's kind of anticlimactic because you end it with just like pressing one button, and you don't even get to do like the swinging yourself, which was really frustrating to me. But they tried to make it, you know, a very cinematic ending. Still going. We're not even back to the rooftop yet. I think that's it, yeah. And so you can see that there's, you know, a lot of work went into making the player feel awesome about what they just did. But then even small things, and some games do a really great job at this. Ocarina of Time is just one of them. A lot of games have adopted this sort of thing, but the idea is just whenever a player does something right, if it's not immediately apparent visually, use some other method, use some other channel to do that. And sometimes it is easy to do it visually, but you want to use any channel you have at your disposal, whether that's vibration through the controller or a sound effect or whatever. And so if you listen carefully here, not a puzzle, right? All Link needs to do is push the block onto the Switch. And it's just a straight thing. There's like, this is a very, very early on in the game, but just listen to the little feedback that you get. Right? You hear that? Guess what? You won. You did it right. Over and over again, all throughout the game, just keep reinforcing it. This is a little win, a little win, a little win, a little win. And it just trains the player to know that they've done something right the whole way along. And it, especially because it's consistent, it's always that little sound. Players start to, like, that's a really great moment. You're like, yes, I got it right on the first try. So, those are some specific moments, mostly from Ocarina of Time, but also from some other games. We're going to watch that video of Pac-Man one more time, and now think about some of the moments that I mentioned here, and just in general, like actual memorable moments that you have from the last time. I'm going to give you guys like 10 or 15 seconds before I bring this up again. Just think back of like the two or three that you actually remember from watching the video the first time of like this specific level. And then we'll watch it and we'll watch it again and kind of try to pay attention to the specific moments that feel really interesting and really compelling. Also, I love the talking about like, you know, being a good teacher. This is the entire tutorial, right? In the intro here. This and like whatever was on the side of the case. They didn't have tutorials in arcades. It was just this. But this shows you absolutely everything you need to know about the game, which is awesome. So that's 10 points. That's 50 points. Here's what happens when you eat a power pellet. Every ghost goes up in the amount of points that they are. That's it. There you go. Entire game. Ha ha ha! And then on to the next level. So, anybody have any interesting moments that they thought happened during that?
Yeah, I did pop out when my captain paid the
thing. Yeah, the ghosts have their eyes like go back to the starting point. Yeah, that's always that's a really cute little like animation, but it also lets you kind of keep track of where they all are on the screen at all the times. Yeah, definitely eating a ghost is a good moment. Anybody else?
The moment he was trapped in the corner for a second.
The close calls, right? And we'll take a look at those. That's always the most interesting ones that people remember. Is just like, oh man, he's so close, he just like narrowly made it. But there's actually a lot in here. So like beating the level is a moment. It's not very exciting. All it does is kind of like flash a little bit. But I mean, if this was your last quarter, then it might be exciting because you keep going forward. Eating a power pellet, right? Like, that's a really great moment. Now you're safe for a certain amount of time. And you can go eat the ghosts. Eating the ghosts, which we mentioned. Eating a bonus fruit, I don't think he does it in here. But that's certainly a great moment if you can get to the bonus fruit. Having a close call, right? This is sort of what the game's all about. There was a really, there's a really great blog post, and I think it was a GDC talk about looking at the sort of fun factor of first-person shooter games and which parts people found the most fun. And when you're a sniper, it's like the least interesting because you're so far away from everything. You're always safe. You're never in like sort of a close call. But the like melee combat was the most interesting because it's so high risk and you're so close. And there's something about that inherent danger that makes it interesting. Losing a life, so that doesn't happen in here, but that's certainly a moment. Outsmarting a ghost, which is really great. Like, that was he waits, knows it's going to go by, then moves. And then going through a tunnel, which we actually don't have in this particular level. But so these are all the different types of moments you can see in Pac-Man. Now we're going to talk about, now we're able to sort of look at these moments and pull them out. Now, how can we bring these into a good experience? How can we start to like architect an experience based around these moments? Has anyone heard of the idea of interest curves before? So this is a idea from Jesse Schell. So he made this book in the deck of cards. So the deck of cards is super useful. If you find yourself, you guys probably have a copy or something kicking around, but it's just full of questions you can answer about your game. But this actually, this book and kind of covers this, and part of it is talking about interest curves. There's also a paper. He actually wrote a paper on this that I recommend checking out. It's really interesting. So, interest curves. The quality of entertainment experience is determined by how well the sequence of events is able to hold the interest of the audience. Now, interest can be a number of different things. It's not always good. Sometimes it's bad. You know, like, horror movies are able to keep you really interested because you're really scared. So the emotion is kind of a separate question. It's just like, how interesting can this be? And this is really hard to, it's really hard to determine interest. It's one of those like taste things. But how many people are familiar with the three-act structure? Right? Most of you should be. This is basically an interest curve. This shows you, you know, how the rising action comes in and kind of makes it more interesting. And then you have this crisis and then the sort of wrapping it up. This is like a very basic look at an interest curve. It turns out that there's like a lot of different variations of this sort of idea. But what we're going to look at is basically what makes a good one and what makes a bad one. So a good interest curve has a couple of key pieces that are important. One is, it's very rare that someone starts at interest zero. Like, there's all this like marketing, right, that comes before this. And there's other things like a friend recommending it. Now I'm interested. You know, I'm going into this experience with some inherent interest. Now if someone hypes it up and then it's like the hook is not that big, then we're in trouble, right? Now we're in a bad situation. That's something you'll notice. And then very quickly we have this hook, right? This is something that is pretty common in most entertainment experiences these days because attention spans have become so short. You really need to get someone hooked right away. And then you have this series of kind of rising and falling sets of interesting moments that happen, and then a peak, and then we sort of have the taper off at the end, and then we don't end at zero interest, right? Ideally, in a good interest curve, you end up leaving the player with some amount of interest, so that way they might buy the sequel or tell a friend about the game. You actually don't want them to end in this in the sort of negative interest space. So bad interest curve. So this is bad, right? Coming with more interest than we actually had. We kind of save it. And then we have this point C. This is like a shelf moment where the game goes up on a shelf and no one plays it ever again. There are ways to save it, so there's occasionally opportunities to actually like bring someone back. This can also happen externally. This is one of the reasons why like social games can stick around so much, because you know a friend reminds you of it and you have inherent interest in that friend, and so you're willing to play it with them even though you were kind of done with that game. And then you sort of have this kind of like leaving with a bad taste in their mouth. They're probably not going to recommend this to anybody, and that's bad. So in looking at a structure like this one, you can sort of see how this would map to most games, you know, like looking at Ocarina of Time or looking at Portal, right, in terms of the like difficulty and the interesting things that happen. You know, we start out relatively easy because you're just learning, and then it gets cooler and harder all along the way. One of the things that games sort of do is this idea of like a repeated structure. So this is really common in a game like Ocarina of Time or any level-based game where each level kind of has its own interest curve, right? Either it ends with a mini-boss or some event happens at the end that's sort of interesting. And so most level-based games are built like this, where you actually have, you know, something really interesting happens at the beginning of the level, then you're kind of fighting your whole way through, and you peak, and then you kind of go back down again, and you, in between levels, and you start up again, and you go. And this is something interesting that you'll see is a kind of each one of these experiences, if you break it down further and further. The guys at Bungie like to talk about making Halo was just finding 30 seconds of fun and then repeating it over and over again. Very much like this. There's just like these repeatable instances, these repeatable moments of fun that allow you to kind of build interest over time. Now, to get a little bit more concrete, one of the things that I like to think about when talking about the interest curves is that it's not just the gameplay. People like to think about the gameplay being it, but it's not. Like, there are games, how many people have started a game and the gameplay like kind of sucks, but you've got to finish the story because you want to know. This was BioShock Infinite for me. And so that is, there's a number of different pieces to this interest curve. So if you look at something like Portal, you have, is it okay if I write on a chalkboard? You have this situation where there are several different interest curves. So the Avatar world setting, the story, and the gameplay. Now, early on, the sort of like Avatar world setting is probably going to give you some initial interest because, like, hey, this is a Valve game. The trailer looks kind of cool. She looks kind of interesting. I kind of like the sci-fi Half-Life feel. So that's going to, you're going to have some kind of inherent interest in the world and the Avatar itself, and that's going to go up a little bit, and then it's probably going to like eventually drop away because you've spent a lot of time there. Or it may just continue to kind of go up slowly and then plateau, depending on, you know, your own personal feel. The gameplay, probably going to start relatively low because you don't really know much about it. And then it just kind of keeps going the whole time, getting more interesting. Right? That's one of the things that they do extremely well with Portal. And then you have the story. And the story starts out really slow, right? And you don't really know much. And then it really starts to become more interesting. And then you sort of hit this inflection point at the... Has anyone not played Portal in here? Oh, man. I'm going to spoil it for you right now. You hit this inflection point where you go, like, behind the scenes. And, like, the last, you know, 2 or 3 hours, it's like, wow, this is really interesting. And then, you know, it kind of goes from there. So it's not just single interest curves that you have to worry about. It's actually several different avenues to keep the player interested. Now, Diablo is a more interesting one, in my mind, because what Diablo has is... You have this situation where you have this sort of like world setting, like, okay, I like horror, Diablo's kind of interesting, that like kind of quasi-medieval fantasy seems interesting to me, so that's going to be interesting for a little while, and then it kind of like drops away, right? You've seen everything there is to see. Then you have the sort of like story, which, you know, starts out and is like kind of interesting, but then you play through the whole thing once, and then you play it again in Nightmare, and then again in Hell Mode, and it's the exact same story. So that kind of probably like loses its flavor. And then you have the gameplay, which the gameplay, moment-to-moment gameplay, is sort of like interesting right at first. And like you're getting new, you know, you're getting new skills and everything like that. And then you've unlocked all the skills. And you don't really have anything new. You're just kind of like changing your stat points and it kind of drops away again, right? Because you've beaten every boss and you've played through every level and you have all the skills. All you're doing is adding new experience points and getting new loot. So then you have this investment. This is like your character, right? I've gotten my character to level 45, but I'm so invested. So this starts really low, right? You're not really that invested in the character. You have no idea what they're all about. And then over time, it kind of takes over. And it becomes the thing that's sort of keeping you going when all the rest of the things are less interesting because you just want to get that one more piece of loot or that one more level. And what Diablo 2 specifically has, but you know, a lot of MMOs capitalize on this as well, is you have this sort of unfair advantage of social, right? And so the social can actually like carry the team the whole time, mainly because you're interested in that relationship with that person and you're going into play just because they are too. And so that oftentimes can kind of ebb and flow, but it almost always is going to start with some amount of interest because that's why you're friends with that person in the first place. And so when you look at interest curves kind of carrying through your entire experience, it's not just a single thing. It's actually a number of different things. And it's okay that some stuff just falls away. You know, the story's not that important in Diablo. Like, you play through it once, you find it kind of compelling. But then people continue to play and play and play and play and play. And why? Why are they doing that? It's because things like the investment, it's because things like the social are able to carry that torch for that game. So, let's take a look at Pac-Man. I think this is the last time we'll watch it, but we'll watch it one more time. And what I actually like to do is, and I'll do this for my own games and for other games as well, is actually go through, write down the moments, and write down the time, like the time that it took place in the experience. And I've done this for movies and for other experiences as well. I did this for whitewater rafting once, just for a class. And the reason why... And the reason why it can be compelling is the fact that this will let you really look concretely at the structure. And when you're doing a playtest, it's good to look at that. Like, oh, you know, 3 minutes in, like the player thought they had a great time. And then you can go and figure out what moment mapped to that and how you can make that repeated over and over again. So... we'll watch this one more time. And then try to take a look, if you can, if you guys have notes. Just write down a couple of the interesting moments here, the very specific ones. And we'll take a look at how to actually map this interest curve. So when I teach the students, I oftentimes make them actually pick a game and play through it and keep track of this. The most interesting time I did that was with Left 4 Dead. I made like groups play the same level 4 times and see what the different interest curves were. And it was really hilarious to see because some of them, they had like a really great time in that level. And then the next time they like turned up the difficulty and got killed immediately. And it was like, you know, their interest curve was just miserable for it because they all were like fighting with each other. And so you can do this multiple times. The one thing I would recommend is that just be careful. This can be really annoying to other people if they're like watching, you know, they want to watch the movie too and you keep pausing it to take notes. my girlfriend has been frustrated with me in the past about that. So I sort of cheat a little bit on this one, because I made it seem really interesting that you beat the level, assuming that you would care about that if you put a quarter in. But that's actually not that interesting, right? Like, there isn't that sort of, like, you know, yeah, you beat it, but there isn't the sort of fanfare that you get. How many people play Peggle? Right? You know when you beat a level of Peggle, right? So, but you can see, so we have a couple of interesting things. The ghosts don't come out right away. They come out one at a time. And the interesting thing about that is it gives you an opportunity to, like, get a head start on them, so you're not overwhelmed immediately. So then you have the first power pellet. They eat the first power pellet. And that's kind of an interesting moment, because now they have the power pellet. There's no real ghost nearby yet still. They sort of pop out the top and they go up there, but Pac-Man starts below. So then you have this cherry appearing. And just to touch on that quickly, let's see if I have a... So... Somehow lost the... So, Pac-Man starts down here. The ghosts come out, and they go up, and they give you, they give the player time. The cherry appears right here, and it's kind of an interesting thing. You're like, oh, the cherry's now available. But one of the things you'll notice is, like, it's put here specifically for being high risk, high reward, right? Because there's no pellets dragging you through there. You don't ever have to go that close to where the ghosts are going to be. But if you want to, you can go get it. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's one of those things when that appears, you want to be looking for it. And so then we have the sort of, if you look at number five in here, we have, we're starting to get towards that moment where everybody was like, oh, the first time they saw the level. So we have this sort of like near miss and then outsmarting the ghost. That moment right there is probably the most interesting thing in the entire level, hands down. I mean, you guys saw it. You heard your reactions from people in the audience, right? Like, you saw from people watching this. Then you have a couple of other power pellets. And one of the things that's kind of sad is, like, the very end of this is, like, kind of boring. All the ghosts are on the bottom. They're not really nearby. He eats the last power pellet and just, like, there's no ghost to eat, and just finishes it up. Right? It's not a super climactic ending. It's kind of boring. He's safe, and it's not a problem. But you can see where the interesting moment sort of happened, and what caused that to happen was just all the ghosts being right nearby there. But you can see that it has a pretty good interest curve as far as some interesting stuff rising up and then having a good peak of interest. And, you know, the argument could be made that a lot of this is built so that it does get a little bit easier towards the end, so the player can kind of, like, come back down again before they need to start the next level. So, like, it's actually the second and third power pellets that are, like, the scarier ones, and the fourth one you've already beaten the level, you just need to wrap it up. But this is a way to actually look at bringing those moments into something concrete to help you with your games yourself, is actually taking a look at building these experiences and actually modeling out, this is what the ideal interest curve would be for our first-time user experience, or for, you know, this level or this boss fight, and then seeing how close you can get to that with actual players. So I'm going to move away from moment stuff to talk about two specific tactics, a little bit more tactical on how to do design. How are we doing on time?
Good one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how many people have heard of Flow? Probably a lot of you guys. Good. It's a good mechanic to know about. I won't read that all out loud because you guys have a good idea of what it is. You should pick up the book and read it if you haven't seen it, or at least watch the TED Talk with him talking about it. It's definitely worth the 30 minutes. But one of the things that's important are the elements of flow. So he talks about it a lot, and it seems really complicated. It's like this scary, like, psychological thing. But there's kind of a few main components that anyone can do, and I guarantee it'll make the game better. That's number one, making sure the goal is clear. Number two, making sure that there's feedback immediately all along the way towards the goal. We talked about feedback a lot today. That's really important. And then number three, that there's balance between opportunity and capacity.
So for the goal is clear, about a game where, like, you just want the player to explore? You don't really give them, like, a chest to go back there or whatever.
So, that's fine. I think, like, the goal, there needs to be, you're putting the ball in the player's court to pick a goal that they want to go after, right? You want to make sure that it's clear how they can, what is a good option, you know, saying like, hey, there's a whole bunch of different goals, right? And this is really common in open world games. You know, you look at Grand Theft Auto where it's like, hey, you can follow the main storyline. There's some other crimes going on. And then there are some like little things that are just, if a goal for you is to get to 5 stars and see like how many cop cars you can pile up, that's your own goal. Like, you've created that yourself. You just want to make sure that players can understand and define goals themselves. Now, a more advanced player will certainly be capable of figuring out what they want their own goals to be. But especially early on, you want to make it really clear, because you're kind of introducing them to the world and the mechanics and the systems of the game. But I would say you don't need to... The game designer doesn't need to force-feed the goals. But you will need to give them feedback towards that goal. You know, this is one of those things that the difference between quests and achievements, right? So a quest is something that I say, hey, go complete this quest. Where achievements is like, hey, here's a list of them. Pick any one of them to work at on your own pace. They're both goals. One is like me giving it to you. The other one is me saying like, choose from this menu and go after it at your own leisure. And so that's the way I would kind of think about the difference. They're both still like clear goals to go after with rewards. So this is one of, I think, the most interesting graphs in the book. And so what this shows is challenge versus skill. And this is really important for game developers. I think, like, we talk about flow as being, like, this ideal place. And you'd love to stay in that the whole time, but as you saw from that one level of Pac-Man, it's actually more of a swing, right? You're more swinging from, like, anxiety all the way around to relaxation and then back. And so that's the region that you really want to be in, is figuring out how to do that, how to provide so that, hey, I'm learning a new skill, I'm getting better at it, I'm getting better at it. It's making me less anxious. I hit this flow state where I'm, like, balanced. I'm as good as the challenge you're giving me. And then it just gets easier and easier, and then there's sort of this, that's the sort of rising action, and then you know you have these like little blips in interest. You want to stay away from the bottom three, like worry, apathy, boredom. If you're in that zone, that's shelf moment territory right there. But knowing how to kind of move back and forth between anxious and relaxed is really good, because you actually want to have moments where the player feels challenged. You want that almost always. And then you want to have moments where they can kind of take a break. You'll notice it's a game that's really talked about a ton for its design, but it's actually really well structured in terms of levels, is Gears of War. So Gears of War, level-based, but then they do the encounters, where like, hey, you're like, oh my god, there's an encounter, there's a whole bunch of guys. And then they have these breaks, where they tell you straight up, like, with a sound effect and with dialogue, this encounter is over, you can relax, and we'll move along to the next one, and then we'll start again. And that sort of gives you an opportunity to have, like, really anxious right away, there's tons of guys everywhere. You sort of, like, move through that all the way down to being, like, relaxed again, because you've cleared it all the way out, and you have a little bit of time before your next encounter, and then it's back up again. So we look at Pac-Man. A couple of things that happen here. The challenge changes over time. There's a couple of different ways in which it changes. One is the power pellets start to last shorter times, shorter durations. And so it makes it, you know, harder. Feedback is instant. There's feedback in a number of different ways. We already talked about how the pellets themselves give player feedback on sort of their progress towards their goal at any given time. But there's all these other ways that Pac-Man is showing you progress towards completing that mission or completing this level. It's things like the music, right? The music, the sound, like, gets like higher and higher and more and more intense as you get closer to finishing. You have all sorts of, you know, you have the actual different ghosts coming out, sort of giving you feedback as to how far you're going. You have the actual 4 power pellets that you need to eat. There's a lot of feedback on how you can get to the end of the mission. you have this sort of new opportunities appearing. So things like the cherry, the bonus fruits, and you have this like strong tense and release. This actual like, hey, you know, oh, they were really close by. I just got the power pellet. I was able to eat them all. I know I'm safe for a little while, and then I'm back in again. And that's seen on the micro level in a level, and then afterwards you sort of have this 10 to 15 seconds before you start the next level where you sort of like have a second to relax, right? Take a swig of your soda while you're playing. So when we're talking about flow, it's covered a lot, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but that was mainly the thing that I wanted to cover is just think about it in terms of not just the flow you're going for, but actually how to move a little bit outside of that and kind of oscillate back and forth to keep interest up. So now indirect control. How many people have heard of this idea, indirect control? So basically, this has a lot to do with like a tell is a great example of indirect control. What you're trying to do is get the player to do what you want them to do without them knowing that you're making them do it. And this is basically all game design, right there. So you want to basically set up the player as much as you can, guide the player, teach them, and then end up challenging them, help them if they need help, and do all that without them noticing. And so this is one of my favorite things in indirect control. So there's this idea in sort of like city planning architecture of wayfinding. It's like how you can make your way around subway systems and things like that, because we just understand and recognize maps and certain signage and things like that. It turns out that if you put a road in a game, players will follow that road. If you put a light source near something, players will look towards that light source if everything else is dark. Right? This is a lot of just ways you can direct the player. And so we'll talk through some ways of using indirect control. And don't worry, we're almost wrapped up. So goals, rewards, interface, visual orientation. This is the wayfinding piece I was telling you about. For anyone that's a level designer or wants to be, it's super important. And non-visual feedback, ways that you can actually do non-visual feedback. So number one is goals. What do you do in this game? Right? I don't need to give you any sort of, you know, we don't need to have a discussion of the rules of the game or what you're supposed to do. You can pretty much just pick that up straight from there. Right? Man, you really want to shave that piece because, God, it looks so out of place. This sort of thing is just a clear challenge, right? Some sort of inherent aspiration. People like to clean things up when stuff is, you know, when a pattern is broken, it drives humans crazy. So you want to shave that man for whatever reason with the world's with the world's smallest razor. I don't know why it's so small. You want to have the skills to complete the challenge. This is part of the flow part, right? Like making sure that players know how to do it. So this is only challenging because you need to see this, recognize it, and then do it in a very limited amount of time. You can see the timer up at the top and you have 10 seconds. But it's super simple. You're able to do it and figure out what you need to do right away. There's no reason for me to follow up or put instructions on the screen that's like, hey, shave this guy, right? You just know. You just know what it needs to be. And that's just making a clear goal. Then there are ways to actually do this with rewards, right? Turns out if you want the player to go one direction or another direction, if you put a big coin down one direction, they're probably going to go that way. And this is a way to sort of give people to get players to move through your game in a specific way, is to put rewards there, like breadcrumbs, just breadcrumb it out. So if you give a clear reward and you have some amount of in-game aspiration to get that reward, that can be really useful to drive the player to do specific things, as long as they have the skills to do it. So we talked about this in a little bit of the risk versus reward part with Ocarina of Time. If you don't have the skills to do it, like you're definitely going to lose there, but it's also kind of, it's setting you up to have this intense moment by like trying to go after that stuff. You know it's going to be risky, but it'd feel really great if you got it. Interface. So you can do a lot of stuff with the interface just to set the player up to like kind of explain to them what they're going to be doing in the game, the sorts of things. Like, what do you think you do in this game? So the interface matters a lot in terms of explaining, you know, third person versus first person camera versus, you know, cockpit. this sort of thing can be really important to just set the stage and get the players to make the choices you want them to make. It gives context, which is really important for, you know, it gives context and motivation, right? Like, I get it. I'm in the cockpit. What would someone do in the cockpit of an X-Wing fighter, right? It's very clear what your motivation and actions would be. And you cause the player to behave in a very specific way. You know, if you've ever played a game where you're just like, I don't know why the game's making me do this, it's missing out on something here. It's missing out on sort of providing you the motivation as to why you'd want to do this, whether it's the reward or it just doesn't make sense for the type of character you are or the type of world that you're in. My favorite sort of indirect control breaker is when you run into an invisible wall in a game. You ever done that where, like, you could go off the cliff, but the game developers are like, we don't want you to do that. We're just going to put an invisible wall here. And you're just, like, running your character up against it, and they're just, you know, still moving but not going anywhere. You know, that's an example of, like, direct control. Now some games that do it well do things like, oh, the wind just, like, blows you back. Or you can fall off, and then you get kind of, like, picked right back up again. This is what, you know, Grand Theft Auto did originally when you fell into the water, which for whatever reason you can do everything in the world but swim in, like, you know, the early 3D GTAs. But it's setting you up in a context that sort of makes sense and not just, like, hammering you with it, which indirect control is all about, this sort of subtlety, making these decisions and making these choices without the player knowing that they're making them. Visual orientation. So where do you think you're supposed to put the portal? They put a big light on it, and then they pick a, like, lighter section of the wall to actually show you where it should go. This is a lot with wayfinding. All about using things like paths, right? People will follow a line. They will follow a road. Using things like lights. If anyone is, you know, into theater or, like, scenic design, a lot of these ideas carry over. You know, if you have a single person stand in the middle of the stage towards the front, they're going to, like, have control over the scene, and then if you put someone else, like, back there that seems out of place, they're going to get all the attention. So there's a lot of things you can learn in terms of how to do visual orientation. Things like size can really help with this. You know, if you make one door bigger than the other, players will probably trend towards one. And then the thing that doesn't belong. This is something that's used all the time, which is, you know, we showed this a little bit in the goals one, the fact that, like, oh, there's, like, four whiskers on that guy's face and they just don't belong. That's a really easy way to orient someone, is to, like, set up a pattern that they clearly understand and then show that there's something different about it. Then non-visual feedback. So this is things like, I wish I could find a video for this, but I can't. How many people played Luigi's Mansion, like, on the GameCube? So this game does, like, the best job, in my opinion, of any game in having the, like, character. So you're not, you know, you're playing as Luigi, but his reactions are so hilarious. He's, like, walking into a haunted house knowingly with a vacuum cleaner, but still scared at, like, every single ghost that pops up. And it's really great. And they do a great job kind of giving and providing feedback as to what's happening. And the character is one avenue, but there's also things like sound and music, which we talked about for Pac-Man. The rumble, right, which is great, a great bit of feedback. The interface itself, actually changing the interface. And then character, the actual, like, avatar. I mean, we saw what happened when Link learns that ocarina, that song on the ocarina, and he gets, like, so excited. And he's like, oh, man, this is magical. And, you know, the, like, da-na-na, when he gets something new, you feel great about it. And the reason why you feel great is because he feels great, and you empathize with him. And so when we look at Pac-Man, you have a whole bunch of things for indirect control. The pellets, like, indirectly lead the player to all the different parts of the map, which inherently means they're going to run into the ghosts, right? They have to go up to the top at some point, and the ghosts are most likely going to be up there. The fruit. Right? Oh, it's so tempting to go after that fruit. And you set the player up to have this, like, risk versus reward challenge moment. The music, having it increases the intensity of the, you know, you're hearing it rev up as you're getting closer. The power pellet transition. You know immediately, like, oh, man, I'm, like, way more powerful, and now I can go after and eat the ghosts. And so those are just some of the things for indirect control. We could talk a lot more about the reason why the level's laid out the way it is and the fact that it's not symmetrical top to bottom. And there's a lot that you could look at here where the game itself is set up to have the players make specific decisions that make them feel smart, even though they're set up by the designers to do that. So that's it. So that's the things that we covered. And I just want to leave you guys with my sort of rules of game design that didn't necessarily fit anywhere in here, but that I like to think about is always use reality to reinforce gameplay if you can. The reason why that razor analogy works as a game is because like we all understand that from the real world. We had this very hard lesson we learned when I was at Zynga. We were trying to make a adventure game for people that had never played games before, and we had this idea where you were in an isometric view, and you could actually like walk up the stairs. You could like go for height, and most people that played the game had either never played a game before or only played something where it was like flat 2D. And we had all this trouble. No one understood that they needed to go up the stairs, and we all were like, why isn't this working? And it turned out that we were just using the different platform levels as our stairs, and we didn't actually make them look like stairs. As soon as we changed that art, everybody got it immediately. So use reality to reinforce gameplay. It's one less thing you need to teach the player, and you only get a limited number of things. Be consistent. The fact that same sound effect is in all through Ocarina of Time telling you that you did a good job is really important. Players are going to come into this like new world that you've created, and every time you break your own rules by being inconsistent, they're going to question all the other things that you've set up. So make sure that you are staying consistent. If snakes only come out of bushes, they need to always only come out of bushes. Don't change it up once just for this one boss fight, because I guarantee it will take away from the experience. Rule of three. How many people have heard of this? Three is always the right number. Four is too many. Two is not enough. Use three. Just something I like to think about all the time. If there are right reasons to using four, sometimes you can. Deliver on promises. So, just like when we talked about interest curves, players are going to come in with some amount of interest to your game, or they're going to have some amount of interest when they start your game, or when you set up a quest or anything like that. That's making a promise to the player. You need to deliver on that. Otherwise, they will be in a bad place in terms of when they actually find out what's at the end of that rainbow. So make sure you're delivering on promises. Feedback. We talked a ton about it, about all the different ways to give feedback, all the different moments. Every time you sort of sit down and you're like, man, I wish this was a little bit more fun, think if there's another way you could give feedback to the player. Think if there's another way you can sort of make that feedback more interesting and more awesome. And I'm pretty sure that the end of Peggle, the end of a level in Peggle, didn't start out with like the 1812 overture or whatever it is, right? Like they got there by just saying like, how can we make this more insane? How can we like make this a bigger, make this feel more awesome? And it turns out like fireworks help, and you know, so find ways to give feedback. Set goals, both in games and in development, but also just you know. Making sure that players know either how to find their own goal or what the goal should be. And the very last one is simplify. This is one of the things that is the hardest thing to do, I think. I'm still not great at it. It's really easy to try and fix a problem in the game by adding something else. But, you know, I saw a really great quote recently that was just like, the game's not done when you're done putting things in. The game's done when you're done pulling things out. And that's very much, I think, something to think about when you're with your games, is if there's pieces that don't quite fit, sometimes it's better to just take them out entirely. And that's it. So thank you guys for listening and participating and watching lots of Pac-Man. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. So.
Could you explain what you were saying earlier about winning a game without knowing it?
Yeah, so I was trying to think of a good example of this. There's, in certain cases, like some moments where players can like win a game either by accident or because they do you have a...
Yeah, so sometimes in a board game you're playing and then someone else might point out, wait a second, hold on. Like, the game's already over, someone already won. And that's kind of in climactic, like, oh, okay, oops.
Right. Yeah, a lot of it is basically like... the reason why I point that out is because there are games, there are situations where all the other players can lose, and then you win by default, right? So it's like, hey, if all the other players lost, the win feels less valuable. It's just like not as interesting of a moment. So making sure that you find ways that the player always feels like they're the reason they won. It's not because they got lucky. It can be because they got lucky, but not shouldn't do that all the time. But you can do that some of the time. Any other questions? Cool. Thank you.
Actually, as another example of that, which was games with Total War.
Yes.
Especially competitive games. The game could have been over a long time ago, but because it's Total War, you don't usually do it until you perform a much to be crippling or blow, which is more satisfying than the game deciding there's no way your opponent's coming back from losing games.
Yeah.
That's just the kind of.
Yeah. What I was trying to point out there is that it's not enough just to win. Actually, like, the avenue, the, like, way you won is important to that moment, and it's something to, like, consider because, you know, for anyone that's fought, you know, a really bad boss fight where you're just like, God, why did they make this so easy? This is so lame. Like, winning doesn't feel that great anymore.
So currently my group is making a game where there's, like, no clear endpoint at the moment, and you just sort of, like, keep fighting monsters until you die. So is that, like, in terms of, like, making the player feel like they won, is there a good way to do that? Is this, like, another case of, like, setting their own goals?
So these types of games are hard. This is, like, you know, the idea of Infinite Runner or Tetris, right? You don't win Tetris, you just lose at a higher level with a better high score, right? So that's what they did, right? They put the focus for Tetris on high score. Same with Pac-Man, right? You can beat Pac-Man, but man, like, do you have 5 hours? But usually the goal you're going after is a high score. So having some goal outside of that, whether it be, you know, Infinite Runners are a great example of this in sort of like a modern day game design challenge where you see, you know, Tiny Wings, which was like probably one of the most interesting kind of Infinite Runners, has a bunch of like little quests that you sort of do, and it's okay that you lose every once in a while, but it can be hard because that can be a real turn off to players, the fact that like they never feel like they win, they just like it gets so crazy towards the end and then they just kind of like the game ends, so it's hard to make that ending feel good. So whatever you can do to say, like, hey, new high score, like, that's awesome, to kind of counteract the fact that they're likely losing because they're just getting so overwhelmed in the anxious part that they just don't have the skill, is a challenge. So.
In terms of interest curves, is that something that you plan out in the beginning? Or is that something that you do a lot of, like, analysis happening where you want
to see how it's really hard to do that from the beginning. You can somewhat, I've done it with very simple games, done with like board game prototypes and things like that before that are relatively easy to kind of keep in my head, where I've actually sat down and been like, what are the interesting moments I want to have happen, and then like, when can I get them set up to do it? But almost always this is in the like iteration phase where it's like, hey, here's the interest curve. What's going on here? Is there anything that we can do to make this better? And looking at this in terms of playtesting and then iterating, it's very hard, I think, to start out with an interest curve. I mean, you roughly can figure out the structure, like three-act structure style, like, hey, towards the end, there should be some amount of climax and something cool should happen. And there should be a hook somewhere in the beginning. But in terms of getting really concrete with it, you know, I don't sit down and be like, hey, this is a five-minute session, this is what I want to have happen. Once you are at the point where you can test that, which hopefully doesn't take very long because you can prototype it, that's when you can actually start really getting concrete with those and iterating on them.
Is that for?
It's a microphone. I'm streaming this to Twitch. It's nice because it can do 360, which is, we use it. We, at Proletariat, we stream our weekly review meetings on Fridays that shows like everything that went into the game, and so we just put this in the middle of the table and it can get everybody, which is nice. So. Anything else? All right, thank you guys very much.
So how do you find this so that you're currently in
which one? I have like lists of moments, all like sticky notes and lists of all over the place of like pieces of the gameplay. So World Domination is kind of a tower defense and reverse tower defense game. So the experience for a single level is very short, like 3 to 5 minutes. So it's really easy for me to sit down and be like, all right, tower defense is an easy one for this, but you just look and you're like, all right, the wave comes up, I need to make some choices here, some like key decisions. And so I actually look through this and try to write down and like watch other people play and build the interest curves on this. And I started out the game very early on. It was like, what are the moments that we think are going to be interesting? Because that's where we want to invest a lot of our time in, like, making sure that the UI is really awesome, that it has a great sound effect, that it feels really good when this moment happens. Because you can't do it for every moment. You just don't have enough time. So you need to pick the ones that you think are going to be really valuable. So that's what I sort of did early. Now we're at the point where we're playing the game a lot, and I do interest curve style, like sit down, look at the course of a single like 5-minute session, a single tower defense mission, and try to figure out like how can I make this more interesting. You know, we've toyed a lot with the sort of ending. To like give you a concrete example, we keep going back and forth on whether or not it should be 5 minutes to end it, or it should be when the last zombie dies. So it's like, you know, waves of zombies. The reason why the 5 minutes is interesting is because you're trying to protect these like buildings, like these hospitals, and there could be a whole bunch of zombies around, but the time ends and you're like, yes, like I just snuck away. Some of the time. Other times you're like, oh, I have to wait for these 5 minutes to go and I've already killed all the zombies. Or like, you know, I'm definitely going to win this. It's not a big deal. And then for the wave-based one, it's you lose some of that. You lose the sort of the like, I just made it. You know, I made it because I was able to get rescued rather than I was able to kind of like wipe all these guys out. And so that's something we've been going back and forth about in terms of like the climax, what makes for a better moment there. And we probably switched it up 2 or 3 times now and tried several different things. So we did, you know, there's a finale and zombies just come from everywhere in the last 30 seconds and you just need to make sure you survive. That felt weird because it meant like it didn't really matter what you did for the first 4.5 minutes. It was like just surviving that. So, you know, it's doing these iterations on specific, this one in this case, specific moments, but also just the overall experience. Like we've looked at how many different waves should happen. Should it be 6 or should it be 8 or should it be 4? And like how long should they be? And what is that, you know, what does that mean? And so that's how I apply it right now, is like very specifically to that bit of gameplay. When we get further along to have more progression, we'll be looking much more of like over the course of playing the game, you know, which levels actually have interesting rewards and things like that. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks.
Okay, so we've got 1.5 hours left of class. So what we're going to do for the rest of the class is actually let you work in your groups. Before we do that, though, I just want to warn you about next Monday. For Monday, you have due a sprint task list. And we're going to do an activity in class where each of the groups is going to show the sprint task list from the prior week and then the current sprint task list. And we're just going to analyze as a group, like, how did you make the decisions you did? How are you figuring out which tasks go on the next one? How are you figuring out which things to pull from your backlogs? Just so that what we want to do is try to give you a little bit more feedback for each sprint as you're working through your games, rather than you get a bunch of feedback like midway through. It'll be really immediate doing it that way.
It's a large chunk of that is to look at task lists and say, hey, is this being an effective tool for your teams, or is it just one more thing that you're filling out and dumping up on the website because you know you have to turn it in?
Yep.
And our goal is to make sure that it is being an effective tool for your teams, not just one more thing that we're helping you jump through along the way.
Okay. So if you want to work in here, one of us will be in here to answer any questions you might have. Feel free to go look in another room if you like as well.
If you take advantage of the fact that you're all in the same place at the same time in the next 1.5 hours.
Content from the following sources is copyright of the respective holders, all rights reserved, excluded from our Creative Commons license. For more information, see ocw.mit.edu/fairuse. Parkman. Namco. 1980. Video game. Legend of Zelda. Ocarina of Time. Nintendo. 1998. Video game. Fumbling Trices. Rare Mount Drop World of Warcraft. May 20th, 2012. YouTube video.